Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we visit with Dr. Rick Hodes, an American medical doctor specializing in cancer, heart disease, and spinal conditions, who's worked in Ethiopia for over 30 years saving lives. He's the medical director of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. Dr. Hodes' practice in Ethiopia has been dubbed the largest collection of the worst spine deformities in the world. Welcome.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
We're so lucky to have you here. You were in town to talk at the Falmouth Forum on Friday night, and it was great. We've taken advantage of that and getting you in here on The Point. So you did not set out to spend your career or much of your career in Ethiopia. So tell us a little bit of how that happened. How did you happen to go to Ethiopia?
You know, I somehow went to medical school, and I graduated in 1982 from University of Rochester. Knowing that I wanted to have a career in global health, what is now called global health, there's no career path, and there's no way of doing that well. Unless you come from family money, which I wish I did, it's tough to sustain yourself. And so as a medical student at Rochester, I spent a summer in Bangladesh. I spent a winter in South India. I worked with Ethiopian refugees, and then I worked in the famine in Ethiopia in 84, 85. And then I said, okay, I've had enough of Ethiopia. What I want to do is I want to work somewhere else in Africa for a year. And I applied for Fulbright, and the Fulbright people saw my resume and said, Ethiopia, he's been there. We're trying to establish cultural relations with the new communist government. And they said, would you be willing to go to Ethiopia? Because I had applied for Southern Africa. And I said, yeah, I need a job. I want to go overseas and I need a way of supporting myself. So if you want me to go to Ethiopia, I'll go to Ethiopia. So I went to Ethiopia in 1985, right out of internal medicine residency in Baltimore, intending to spend 1 year teaching and practicing at the medical school. And that 1 year turned into 2.5 years. I kept on renewing. And so then after 2.5 years, I said, okay, you can't do Fulbright forever. And I was offered a job by the World Health Organization. So I said, okay, I'm out of here. I'm going to join the WHO. The WHO job was in Burma and Myanmar now. And there was a revolution around the same time. And so the job got canceled. So I was not able to take that job. So I ended up back in Washington, D.C. I have a Maryland medical license, so I got a job working in a practice. And I liked practicing medicine, so it was fine. Very flexible. I'd ride my bicycle there every day, see patients all day long. It was outpatient, primary care, internal medicine, exactly what I was trained to do. But then I started going to Israel. And in Israel, I was reading about the problems of the Ethiopian Jews because they were stuck in Addis Ababa. So I wrote a letter to the organization I work for now, the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, and I said, you know, I'm an American doctor. I happen to be Jewish. I just spent 2.5 years in Ethiopia. I speak the language. I know many of the doctors in the country. Can I help you? So they hired me to be the doctor for the Ethiopian immigrants to Israel.
Right. And the Operation Solomon, as it was called, right, airlifted 14,400 immigrants to Israel in 24 hours.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. May 24th, 25th, 1991.
Wow. So, and you told a great story. And sometimes miracles really do happen, right? And I think you've seen some miracles in your time. Tell us about the boy with meningitis and the mom who wouldn't leave the hospital. You're trying to get them on this, you know, get them to Israel. And mom doesn't want to leave, right? Because she's waiting, for her brother?
Yeah. So I had a kid with meningitis in one of the city hospitals. He was in a small, crowded room where the kids were on the outside of the room. The moms were on the inside of the room. The kids were very small. And I went up to her and I said to her in Amharic, but the other moms heard this, today we can leave. There's a flight to Israel. I didn't want to tell her there's a whole airlift. So I said, there's a flight to Israel. And she said, I'm not leaving. I said, why not? She said, my brother said to meet him here at 3:00. And I said, you have to. And she said, no. And then I said, well, I'll just lie. And I say, your brother's waiting for you at the Israeli embassy. He must have been, right? And she said, no, I'm not leaving. So she absolutely refused to leave. So what could I do? I go back to the Israeli embassy. And I had to park half a mile away because all these people were coming, not only the Ethiopian Jews, but everybody else who was trying to figure out what's going on and see what, you know, see what the commotion was. So I walked in and I walked into the embassy. When I walked out, I was literally, I mean, there were thousands of people all over the place. Some guy just tapped me on the shoulder and I said to him, Mindanao, like, what do you want? And he said, doctor, you need to help me. My sister's in the hospital. Her kid has meningitis, and I'm here. What should I do? And I said, oh, my gosh. It was like a needle in a haystack, identifying, you know, tapping me on the shoulder. And I said, let's go. So we get in my car. We drove to the hospital. He stood at the door. The woman looked up, and she said, ish, which means okay. And, you know, we took out his IV, and he got in the car.
And boom, there you go.
And that was it. But, like, that was to my, as a person of faith, that was the hand of God, because otherwise, like, what are the chances that I would just be standing there and like that?
And he was happy in the soul. So tell us a little bit more about what you call home, Ethiopia, both the place and the people.
Sure. So Ethiopia is about the size of Colorado times four. And we in Ethiopia have about 120 million people. It's the second most populated country in Africa. Nigeria, by far, has over 200 million. And then we are number two. One-third of the land and two-thirds of the population are in the Highland Plateau. So in Addis Ababa, where I live, and by the way, Addis Ababa means new flower in Amharic, in Addis Ababa, there's probably 5-6 million people. And we're about 7,500 feet above sea level. So it's cool. At night, it's really on the cold side. You need an extra layer. And you see pictures of Ethiopians, and they have their traditional garb, but it's different ways of wearing an extra layer at different times of the day. On a good day, we have cell phone service and electricity and running water. And on a bad day, we don't.
And what is the healthcare situation like there? I'm, you know, like here in the United States, one doctor in every, 349 people? How many doctors are there to serve this population?
Oh, I had that in my talk. I think
I have it here. It was one in 13,341.
Yeah. So it's... And there's also a disproportionate geographical distribution, so that many of the doctors are in the city. And in the countryside, there are areas with much, much fewer doctors. The government has done a great job in producing new doctors, opening medical schools, producing new doctors, and improving the health services and the distribution of health services. A lot of this was done by Dr. Tedros, who's now head of the World Health Organization. And he did a wonderful job in trying to revitalize the health services, which hadn't been in such good shape before he took over.
You mentioned something when we met on Friday that I thought was interesting, that every time you come to the United States, you try to bring a wheelchair back with you. And that made me wonder about the resources that you have available to you. What is that like?
Yeah, so wheelchairs are tough to get in Ethiopia, and they're on the expensive side. And for us Amazon Prime members, a decent wheelchair is about $125. So when and wheelchairs by airline rules are free. So I bring a wheelchair back all the time. And I always have an extra wheelchair at home, because some patient is going to come in and say, I need a wheelchair. Do you have any idea how I can get one? I say, yeah, come back tomorrow and I'll, you know, so. Yeah. So I have a little wheelchair storage in my house.
Yeah. What about other resources there? Are you able to get what you need?
Often we are. I mean, for example, there are lots of cats. I've been doing this. I opened up the spine program, you know, 16, 17 years ago. And things are better now. For example, I remember when we started out, there were no MRIs. So we had to do sort of different ways of doing CAT scan with dye injections, and that's more difficult, more painful. And now we just do MRIs to visualize the spinal cord.
Yeah. In 1999, volunteering at Mother Teresa's mission, you met two abandoned orphans with tuberculosis of the spine. You knew that if you did not get them surgery, they would likely become paralyzed, die early. You went above and beyond what most doctors would do. You adopted them and put them on your insurance.
Yeah. I was working there doing rounds one Saturday, and we got an admission of two boys at the same time who came from different parts of the country. They actually spoke different languages, and they couldn't even speak to each other at the time because one of them spoke a language called Oromo, and one of them spoke the main language called Amharic. But they bonded with each other because they looked the same, they had the same deformity, and the older one was actually shyer than the younger one. And the younger one would bring him food and force him to eat. And really, the younger one saved the older one's life. Mm. And I wanted to help these guys because I knew that they're young, they're still growing. And if they didn't get surgery, they could easily become paralyzed. So, you know, I did x-rays and photographs and asked around, and nobody would touch them. And then I got this brilliant idea that I could adopt them, add them to my health insurance, and bring them theoretically to the United States and find some great surgeon to operate on them. Now, the problem is these are abandoned orphans who don't have any relatives. So when you adopt an abandoned orphan who doesn't have any relatives, they become yours for life.
Mm-hmm.
So on one hand, I could save their life. On the other hand, we'd have to spend the rest of our lives together. Like, That's heavy. That's a big deal.
What was your thought process thinking that? You're going, okay, I can save their lives, but now they're going to be mine forever.
Yeah. I mean, it's like that would change their lives and also change my life and give me a lot less flexibility or whatever. Anyway, I was walking along and I looked up and I said to the Almighty, what do you want me to do? Like that. Like that sort of tone of voice even. And, you know, I looked up and there was no answer. So I kept, I'm not like this person who gets messages from God. And that was it. Yeah. And then a few days later, it's as if he sent a fax to my brain. I mean, and this answer just arrived. And it was clear. Like I had this moment of clarity. And the answer was, I'm offering you a chance to help these boys. Don't say no.
Mm-hmm. And where are they today? They're.
One of them is in graduate school in Atlanta, and one of them has a travel business in Ethiopia.
Mm. And they're doing well.
They're doing okay. Yeah.
We're talking with Dr. Rick Hodes. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Dr. Rick Hodes, an American medical doctor specializing in cancer, heart disease, and spinal conditions. He's worked in Ethiopia for over 30 years. He's the medical director of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. You said that volunteering at Mother Teresa's mission changed your life. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it changed a lot of lives, not only my life. You know, I met these two guys, these two abandoned orphans with TB of the spine, and they were my first two spine patients. And I ended up adopting them, adding them to my health insurance, and bringing them down to Dallas, Texas, where they had surgery. And then another patient came along, and I repeated the process, but serial adoption, it's probably not the answer to spine deformity. And so then I met the person I consider the best spine surgeon in the world, whose name is Dr. Boachi. His full name is Oheneba Boachi Aje. And so Dr. Boachi and I started working together. And I opened up the spine program in 2006. That year, I got 20 new spine patients. And we did 11 surgeries. And I thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe how well we're doing, you know, because this is, like nobody's ever done this in Ethiopia. And, you know, and it also has to do with fundraising. And I got somebody to help fundraise for me and to even match the grants for a while. So I had enough money, because when we send these people to Ghana, we have to raise money for them. We have to pay their airfare and we have to pay the Ghanaian hospitals. Hmm. So that was my first patients. Wow. And now, fast forward, we're getting hundreds and hundreds of new deformities a year. We've actually written papers in the scientific literature about the deformities that we're discovering that hadn't been described before. And I believe I have the largest collection of the worst spinal deformities in the world.
I'm seeing the pictures that you showed at the Falmouth Forum on Friday night. I was like, wow. So let's talk a little bit about that. Are most of these spinal deformities from tuberculosis, TB, or are they a range of different things?
So about a third of my patients have TB of the spine. And let me just back up for a minute, because everybody knows TB is a lung disease, but TB can actually affect any part of your body. It can affect the lungs. It can affect with the brain tumors can be TB. Joint problems can be TB. Kidney problems, the lining of the heart called TB pericarditis. So TB is really a multi-systemic disease. It's all over the place. And with that, in Africans and in Asians, it often affects the spine. And it causes a very unique deformity. Scoliosis, we all know, is an S. It's a curvature of the spine. But TB doesn't cause scoliosis. TB causes a V. And so if you look from the side, you'll see a V shape, and that's called kyphosis. And that's what these TB patients get. And we have, so there's TB of the spine. We also, for example, we basically don't have much new polio, but there's old polio. And so that's another cause of a spinal deformity that causes usually a broad curve. There's scoliosis, and the scoliosis can be what they call idiopathic, which means we don't know the cause. And that's the most common scoliosis we see in America, especially in teenage girls. But we also see congenital, and that's people born with abnormal bones. Mm. And bones don't form properly, or they're fused, and the ribs can be deformed as well. And then there's also, that often goes with a spinal cord deformity. So it's a variety of different things that can cause a deformity.
So, and some of the x-rays and things that you showed on your talk on Friday, you could see where the bones are fused, and you just talked about that. Sometimes the bones are fused. So you basically have to break them to fix them, right?
Yeah, you need to break them and keep this spinal cord intact, because the spinal cord is obviously very sensitive. And if you don't do the procedure properly, the patient can become paralyzed. Mm. And that's a big deal.
Yeah.
One of the things we've learned is that paralysis is not necessarily permanent, but it can be.
Right.
And so that's a very big deal. So you need a very competent surgeon to be able to do this. And when you have somebody with TB of the spine, and they may have 110-degree angle in their back, that apex of that angle, you need to remove maybe 2-3 of the vertebra and replace it with a cage. So that's technically, that's called a VCR, vertebral column resection. That's a very big deal.
Yeah. And to what extent, I think there was one woman I saw who had deformed 240 degrees. I mean, what kind of a range are you seeing there? That seems like a lot.
Yeah. So, I was taught that the worst thing that could happen to your spine is that you had a 180-degree curve, which would be like a pancake folded on top of each other. But we actually get worse, because it goes down, it goes up, it goes down again, and so on. So we have these terrible things. But fortunately, the good docs in Dallas, Texas, invented something called halo gravity traction, or we call it ambulatory traction. And they can put four pins against the skull and stretch these kids 23 hours a day when they sit, when they stand, and when they lie down. Mm-hmm. And that helps a lot in correcting the spinal deformities before the surgery. You still have to go. We because of gravity,
right,
we don't live on the moon, so they still need to have surgery afterwards.
So what is the criteria for surgery? When do you say, okay, this is at a point it needs surgery versus traction or something, or bracing or something?
Right.
Like
so
that?
The simple, in America, the recommendation for surgery is about 50 degrees. More, you know, give or take, and it depends on the person and so on. But on the average, 50 degree is the indication for spinal deformity surgery. Mm-hmm. And if you have somebody, it's often a teenage girl getting worse, you know, 15, 25, 35, 45, and you know, let's say it's May and she has a 45 degree curve, the surgeon might say, okay, you're not exactly 50 degrees, but this is a good time to operate because you have the summer to get better and then go back to school in the fall. That would, like, that's a typical scenario here in the United States. So the spine surgeons are very busy the first half of the summer so that the kids can have their spine surgery and then get better to go back to school in the fall. That's in America. So we would still use that as a criteria, the 50 degree curve for starting surgery. And then basically the criteria for traction is double that. It's about 100 degrees. Mm. So between 50 and 100, you can operate without traction, and then above 100 degrees, the surgeons, and I'm not a surgeon, by the way, the surgeons operate after traction.
Right. And then with that traction, you can correct up to what, like 50% before surgery?
You can.
Surgery?
You can get a 50%
correction. That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So what's the cost? What does this cost? I mean, I know it's different in the United States than it is in Ethiopia,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so in America, you can talk, you know, several hundred thousand dollars can be for spine surgery, especially if you're going to, if you're going to do traction in America, that gets really expensive. I know of one case of somebody who had traction in New York City, and his medical bill was $1.25 million.
Oh, my goodness.
So you can imagine why an insurance company would hesitate or be a bit hesitant about that. So it costs us in the area of $25,000, maybe $28,000 in Ghana. And that would include months of traction and then surgery. So we are basically 10% of the cost of the United States. So on one hand, that's a lot of money that I have to raise per patient. On the other hand, it's a bargain.
Yeah,
and we're transforming these kids' lives.
Absolutely.
And these kids have suffered so much. And one of the problems is when your spine is curved, your lungs are compressed. And so we would like the lung capacity to be at least 30% of the predicted lung capacity. And there are formulas to figure out what the lung capacity should be. And if your lung capacity is, you could still be 70% down, but if it's 30, if you still have 30% left, we can deal with you. If it's we have patients with 15% lung capacity, that's just too far gone.
Wow.
And we're afraid, this has never happened to us, but we're afraid that you're going to be dependent on the ventilator after surgery, and that's a terrible thing when that happens. So we don't operate on these kids. That's why we'd like to do early detection. And now we have some early detection programs in Ethiopia.
Right. Michael writes, the story told on Friday at the Falmouth Forum and again this morning is amazing. Dr. Hodes is a true hero. Many thanks for helping to let people know about this amazing person. Can he tell us how to contribute to his work?
Oh my gosh. I didn't plant this gentleman. But, thank you. Yeah, so I work for the JDC. It's an American Jewish organization. And I have my own budget line inside the organization. My program, by the way, is completely non-sectarian. We treat anyone who walks in the door, and everybody does walk in the door. Ethiopia is 2/3 Christian, 1/3 Muslim. I have a website, www.rickhodes.org, R-I-C-K-H-O-D-E-S. And if you donate by credit card through that, it'll go into my budget line inside JDC, and you will get a tax receipt from JDC.
Yeah. And we'll put a link with that on our website so folks can find it
easy.
Right,
and if somebody wants to send, also if they want to send a check or a stock transfer, we can deal with that easily. You can just contact me through my website, and I can give you those instructions.
Mm-hmm. Is there a genetic component to the spinal deformities that you see?
Yeah, so this is, I'm so glad you asked that. So there is a genetic condition called neurofibromatosis. 5% of my patients have neurofibromatosis, which is really unheard of, because if you ask any American spine doc, they'll say, yeah, we see it occasionally. But literally 5% of my patients have NF, and they have these darker spots on their body called cafe au lait spots. And, you know, sometimes a patient will walk in and I'll be writing something, and he or she will be taking their shirt off and I won't be looking at them at that time. And my assistant, who's actually a computer guy sitting on the other side of the desk will look at the patients and just say, doctor, it's NF. Like we're so, we can identify NF in a second. So that's one genetic component. The other thing is we have these patients and we don't exactly know why, but we'll see two or three in a family. And so they may have an undiscovered gene. And so I'm actually looking for some partner organization to work with me and to do some genetic studies on our patients.
Right. Let's talk about some of your patients. You talked about this patient, Danny, which, like, when you first meet Danny, what was he, like eight? He was little, right? 7 or 8 years old?
Yeah. So Danny was a beggar. And a journalist had come to me and said, I saw this kid with TB of the spine. And I didn't trust her diagnostic skills. And this happens all the time. People, you know, come to me and they tell me that. But we actually found him. And, you know, we drove to his neighborhood and talked. If you want to find out what's going on in any, the local word is village, but it would be, we in America, we'd call it a neighborhood in Ethiopia. You ask the shoeshine boys, because they know everything. They know everything. They know who does what and everything. So we said, you know, do you know a kid with a bad back? And they said, yeah, his name is Danny. And they told us about his life and where to find him. And we went to the video store where he based himself. And the owner of the store said, okay, I'll give you a call. And then when he showed up sometime later that day, we picked him up and we admitted him to the mission. And there he had, we treated his TB. And he had both TB of the lung and TB of the spine. That's really bad. And that doesn't happen much. And I mean, I've treated maybe 1,000 cases of TB of the spine. And only a few have had simultaneous TB of the lung as well. So this is a kid who probably would have died because he was in such bad shape.
And now he is doing well. And
now he's a college student in America.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's amazing.
So you talked about...
And I have a lot of these cases.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I have these sort of miracle stories that happen to me all the time. And as a person of faith, I can only say that there is an Almighty who's using me to help people. Yeah. I mean, another story that I didn't tell. When I was in Gondar, Northwest Ethiopia, working with the Ethiopian immigrants to Israel, I would buy soap for my house in Addis from a mentally retarded 35-year-old. A wonderful, wonderful guy. He's like an angel, really. And he would sell me soap. So I was waiting for my soap delivery, and he showed up 45 minutes late, even though I'm like his biggest customer. And so I needed to stretch my legs. So I bought him tea, and I went for a walk to check my email. There was no internet. There was no wireless at the time, but there was an internet cafe. So I was going three doors down. At the moment that I stepped out, somebody in the opposite direction was walking, and it was a 21-year-old guy with his 12-year-old niece. So it turns out she's an orphan. She had a terrible back. He decided to bring her to Addis Ababa, to Gondar, to the hospital there, and see what he could do to try to get her treatment. And they spent 3 days, and after she had proper evaluation, they said, there's no treatment for you anywhere in the world. Mm. And they just sat there, and they cried, and they decided to come into town. They were taking a walk. I was going the other direction.
There you are.
And we stopped. And I said to him, she has a terrible back. And he said, yes, we just spent 3 days at the hospital. There's no treatment anywhere for her. And I said, actually, I'm a spine doctor. Can I help you? And he said, yeah. So I said, here, let me just take a look. So I took her into the internet cafe, and she was just wearing a T-shirt that went all the way down to her ankles. So I pulled up the T-shirt to see her back, but she wasn't wearing underwear. Mm. So I said, oh my gosh, you know, I don't want to expose her in public. And I said to the uncle, can I come to my hotel room? You'll be in the room the whole time. And I'll give her a proper exam. So that's what we did. And at the same time, there was a film crew making a documentary film about something else, some other aspect of Ethiopia. And one of my friends was on that film crew. So I said, I called him and I said, hey, I just met a spine patient. Do you want to come and film? They said, yeah, stay where you are. So literally 5 minutes after I met her, before we got into the car to go to my hotel, the film crew shows up, they put a mic on me, they start filming on the street, and then we went up to my hotel and I examined her. And she's a dwarf, but she had has a congenital spine deformity as well.
And you were able to help her.
And yeah, yeah. I said, you need to come to Addis Ababa and get special, you know, get better x-rays, and then we'll see what we can do. So a few weeks later, they showed up in Addis Ababa, and she actually moved into my house and lived there for a year, and we got her into better nutritional shape. And then she went off and had surgery in Ghana.
Wow.
And now in a week or two, she's going to graduate from college in Oklahoma.
Wow. That's amazing.
With a degree in computer science.
Yeah.
Like, if you had asked me, what are the chances this girl's going to live? I would have said less than 50%. I mean, what are the chances this girl's going to live, graduate from boarding school in Ohio and college in Oklahoma? It's like,
yeah.
Zero.
Wow. No, I'm sure people think that you treat a lot of children, and you mentioned the traction that the kids are in, and then you're putting rods and cages in them. What about their growth? How do you compensate for, right, they're this size now, but they're going to get taller?
Oh, that's a really good question. So there's something called growing rods. There's two ways of doing growing rods. One is you put the rods together in certain ways so that you can adjust them and sort of telescope them out. And the other is now that there's something called the MAGEC, M-A-G-E-C rod, and that can be elongated with electromagnets. And literally, as I speak right now, I have a team, my team from Ghana, from Focus Hospital, is in Addis Ababa evaluating our patients. And it takes us 3 days, but we get permission from the Ethiopian Ministry of Health to bring the electromagnet. It's about the size of a small laptop or something, into the country. And we lie the kids down and we can elongate the growing rods that way. So there's growing rods, and you do that. You put in the rods when they start to deform or when the kids come to you, and then you do the what they call the final fusion early in puberty. So you're following them all the time. Now, there's lots of complications. There's a group in California that published their data. Their complication rate from growing rods was 125%.
Wow.
So everybody has... Something. Is going to have a complication. And we tell the parents that.
Yeah.
And the way I say is that you may have the greatest car in the world, but it's going to be in the shop sometimes. And you're going to have great doctors and you're going to have good potential medical care, but things are going to go wrong, but we can deal with it. Yeah. And, you know, growing rods break, growing rods pierce the skin. It used to make me very nervous when a patient would come in and their rod was sticking out into the air.
Okay.
At first, I would start them on antibiotics. Now I don't. Now we just do local care, local control, and we put in bandages, and we reoperate, and they do fine.
We're talking with Dr. Rick Hodes about his work in Ethiopia. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Dr. Rick Hodes. He's the medical director of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. His practice in Ethiopia has been dubbed the largest collection of the worst spine deformities in the world. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. What about the emotional toll that these kids go through? You talked about the two boys that you adopted and how they bonded. And you have kids who are going through this together, right? So talk a little bit about that, how they deal with the emotional toll of this.
Yeah, you know, the whole key to success is emotional support. And the way to do that is with community. One of the things, when I was treating the Ethiopian immigrants to Israel and diagnosing them with tuberculosis, the way I designed the TB program was to start basically a therapeutic support group so that they would go through their treatment together, they would have classes every day, they would bond with each other, we would have religious leaders coming. And I don't know if anyone's ever run a TB program that way, but it was very, very successful. The same thing with the spine kids. Instead of just sending one kid alone to Ghana, where they're going to be the only Ethiopian and be alone and, you know, be miserable. We send a bunch. So like right now we have 10 kids in Ghana and they go together, they bond with each other, and they go without their moms. Mm-hmm. You know, we have 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds going without their moms, and the older girls take care of the younger kids. Ethiopians are wonderful at taking care of kids, and they bond with each other and they support each other. And it works really, really well. Mm.
Are these spinal deformities something that we see worldwide? Is it mostly in developing countries, or is this everywhere?
Spinal deformities are certainly worldwide, but it's usually simpler than what we have in Ethiopia. Like what I see in Ethiopia, we don't see in America at all. Part of it is because of earlier detection, but part of it is that we have some unique deformities that we need to figure out why. Mm-hmm. We have that. We don't. I mean, some of these crazy curves, and we have one that goes down, and then it goes across, and then it goes down again. In the Ethiopian, in the Amharic alphabet, there's something called a N. So this is a N deformity, we call it, because it's like the Ethiopian letter.
You told a great story about a woman. You had a pregnant woman with malaria, and you were trying to get blood donated for her. I wondered if you'd tell that story.
I had a pregnant woman with malaria, and I needed a blood transfusion for her. I needed 2 units of blood. Now, in the Ethiopian blood bank, you need to donate blood. Ethiopians may not want to donate blood, so you need to donate. You need to put blood into the bank to get blood out of the bank. So I was going to give my own blood, and I needed one other person. So I found a shoeshine boy and offered him $20 to donate blood with me. And he went to the blood bank, and it's a very well-run blood bank. It's clean. It's fine. You know, it's a good blood bank. We would all look at that and say, oh, this is fine. You know, they know what they're doing. And he refused. When he saw the amount of blood coming out, he refused to do it. And then I was... I needed to come up with somebody else. So I went to the Hilton Hotel and I heard some people speaking Hebrew, and I speak a bit of Hebrew. And I said to them, excuse me, my name is Rick Rhodes, medical director of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. I need somebody to donate blood with me right now. And they looked at me. They didn't say a word. They just looked at me. But I knew that they heard me. And nobody said anything. So I let 30 seconds pass, and I repeated it. You know, my name is Rick Rhodes, medical director of the JDC. I need somebody to donate blood with me right now. Finally, one guy said to me, I can't donate blood. And I said, why not? He said, tomorrow is going to be a very busy day, and I don't want to be tired. And I used an expletive that you don't say on the air, and I said, doesn't anyone care? So there's a pregnant woman who's going to die, and you're worried about being tired tomorrow. And I just stormed out of there. This guy ran after me, grabbed me by the shoulder, and stopped me. And he said, doctor, let's go. And I said, what changed your mind? And he said, I have a pregnant wife. Mm. And so he came and he spent, you know, he donated blood. And he was so happy that he did that, you know, like he knew that he had done the right thing.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. It's because of his own pregnant wife that he thought about this other pregnant woman.
Give it a second thought, yeah. So tell us about, you sort of touched on this, your outreach and screening efforts, because you're trying to get these deformities early as you can, right?
Yeah. So now that we're expanding our work, just in the last year or so, we've started outreach. And so I was in Ethiopia a few weeks ago. We went to the town called Bahar Dar. We flew there. It's about an hour flight from Addis Ababa. It's right on Lake Tana, northwest, a few hundred miles northwest of Addis Ababa. And what we did is we hired a car and a driver and a megaphone to drive through the streets and say, if you know of somebody with a spinal deformity, have them come to the university hospital on this Friday or Saturday, and they'll be seen by the group. And then we rented space on the local FM radio, and they made the announcement as well. And we ended up getting, and we said, like, what we don't want is people with bad back, sort of back pain and arthritis. We're not interested in that. We're looking for spinal deformities. So the word that we use the word Amhara for curvature. We ended up getting 165 real deformities. Mm. I mean, like, and this is in a couple of days.
Wow.
We had one guy who walked in and he had an IV in his arm. And I said, like, why do you have an IV in your arm? And he said, I was in the hospital in Gondar because I had malaria, and my younger brother, who has a bad back, took me. And he said, I need to go to see these doctors. They're going to be in Bahardar. And so he ended up, he said, okay. And he pulled out the IV.
I don't recommend this,
by the way. He pulled out the IV, and they got on a bus, and they took the bus to Bahardar, and they walked into our office. The kid is a great candidate for surgery, so we hope to be able to operate on him. Yeah. Now, we also have teams coming from America and doing the simpler surgeries inside Ethiopia, and we call those, quote, American cases. So when we say it's an American case, that means, like, 60, 70 degrees, and we can do that here in Ethiopia. So we love these cases because then we don't have to send them to Ghana. It's much easier, much cheaper.
So you're partnering with doctors, Ghana, Egypt, India, America, right? So this is really becoming quite an effort.
Yeah. We've actually, for example, I had a patient who had a tumor which was eroding, a benign tumor, but it was eroding his spine. And when we did the biopsy to figure out whether it was cancer or not, which fortunately it was not, it bled so much that Dr. Boachi, the surgeon, said to me, Rick, this is really, really vascular. It's bleeding like hell. When he gets surgery, he's going to need what they call embolization. They need to cut off the blood supply. So we actually sent him to India. Mm-hmm. And in India, they did what's called invasive radiology, and they cut off the blood supply. And then the next day, they went and they operated on the area. They removed the whole vertebra, and they put a cage in and so on. Mm. It worked perfectly. I mean, it was just a great thing. And it ended up costing us less than $10,000.
Wow. You've had patients who've gone to great lengths to see you. And I'm thinking of the brothers who, I'll say, traveled 250 miles.
Yeah. We were sitting in the office one day, and these two brothers walked in. I mean, and people walk in all the time. One of them was typically, he had the garb of an Ethiopian priest. So when you see somebody, you know, in any culture who looks like a priest, you say to him, hello, father. And I said to him, hello, father. And he said, hi. And he said, I'd like you to treat my son, my brother. And I said, okay. And I got out. My assistant had stepped aside. So I was doing the intake and writing, what is your name and where do you come from and what's your phone number and all of this stuff. And now at this point in Ethiopian development, many people have cell phones, or they can at least give you a cell phone number. They're not smartphones or anything like that. It's nice to be able to have a phone number that you can reach people. Very important, actually. So I was doing all that, and I looked down, and I saw that their shoes were dirty. And I said, you know, your shoes are in bad shape. They said, yeah, we walked here. And I said, you walked from the bus station? That's 8 miles away. They said, no, we didn't have $20 to take a bus. We walked from Gojam.
250 miles,
yeah. And wow. I said, where did you sleep at night? Because you can't sleep outside at night because there's hyenas. And they said, Xavier Engeda. Xavier Engeda literally just means guest of God. But what it really is describing is a system that the Ethiopians have where you can knock on any door and say, I'm a guest, I'm a stranger. I'm a guest sent to you by God. Please let me in. And the Muslims have the same thing. They call it Allah Engeda, guest of Allah. And 8 nights in a row, people let them into their house. They cook you a meal the way you would cook a guest. They give you a basin of water and soap to wash your feet, and they show you out in the morning. And then they did that 8 nights in a row till they got to Addis Ababa.
Wow.
And then I did it. And I said, okay, now you stay at my house.
So do many of your patients, I mean, how many, you've had so many patients over the years. Do a lot of your patients stay in touch with you and let them know what has happened because of, you know, you helping them?
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time. I mean, I got a call. One of my early patients was a teenage boy, and he was 16 years old. He didn't want surgery. He had congenital scoliosis. He didn't want surgery. His dad said to me, my son is miserable. He never smiles, but he wants to finish high school. He doesn't want surgery. What should I do? And I said, do me a favor. Come to my house. The dad was a bit educated. I said, come to my house 6 o'clock tonight. So he said, fine. So he and his son came to my house that evening. The dad and I sat down, and my teenage son, one of the first two that I adopted, was there. And I said to him, hey, DeJenny, this kid is thinking about spine surgery. Go out into the front, talk about it. So they talked, teenage boy to teenage boy. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the dad and I just sat inside drinking tea and chatting. An hour later, they came in, and the kid said, okay, I want surgery. And he went to Ghana. He had surgery. It was a great success. Mm. Fast forward. He followed up with me every 6 months for a while, and then I didn't hear from him again. And then some years passed. I mean, probably 5, 6, 7 years. And then I got a call from the dad. My son wants to see you. I said, is there a problem? He said, no, it's okay. But he wants to see you. I said, okay, come to clinic tomorrow. So the next day, the son walks in. He's wearing a white coat and a stethoscope. And he said, I just graduated from medical school.
Wow. What a great story. Oh, my gosh. So are you training other doctors to somehow take your place at some point?
That's my goal.
Yeah.
That's my goal. So right now I have two young docs who are working on our team. One is a fully trained orthopedic surgeon. One's a fully trained neurosurgeon. And they work with me several days a week. And the orthopedist was just accepted for a year and a half training program in spines in India. And then we're looking for a place for the neurosurgeon as well.
Mm. You say, come to my house. And I couldn't help but think that, I think you told us there's no street names. How do they find your house? How do they find any house?
It's funny. The way you describe where you live, because there's no street names in Ethiopia. It's a crazy system, is that you talk about what bank you live near or what embassy you live near. So people will say, I could easily say to somebody, where do you live? And they say, I live in Rwanda. It doesn't mean they live in the country of Rwanda. It means they live within walking distance of the Rwandan embassy.
That's interesting. So, and are you able to keep up with the need? You have all these people walking in all the time. Are you able to help everyone?
We can only help a small percentage of the people who come to us. It's difficult for us that we have to choose the best candidates. And some of them are too far gone. And there's, you know, some of them may not have enough social support to get through the surgery. Okay. That's another issue. Because, you know, there's a lot of moving parts. Yeah. But we try.
Yeah.
We keep on going.
Dr. Rick Hodes, an American medical doctor specializing in cancer, heart disease, and spinal conditions. He's worked in Ethiopia for over 30 years. He's the medical director of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. Thanks so much for being with us. We're going to put a link with his website at our website, capeandislands.org. And thanks so much for the work you do. You really are a true hero. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and me, Elsa Partan. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.